Why is it that so many of our cultural stories and things like movies are about princes and princesses and kings and queens? Well, that story is on repeat. If you've seen it once, you've seen it twice. Some child from obscurity or poverty does something heroic, does some heroic act, and suddenly becomes royalty. Right now in the theaters, Disney's Aladdin is in live form, and it bears that basic storyline. Why is that? I think it's because it taps into a visceral part of who we are, a desire that all of us have, no matter how much it's been pushed down or suppressed in our lives. I believe God put it there. But there is this idea, there is this crazy dream, there is this haunting sense inside people that way down deep inside that you were made and forged out of dust for something. The question for a lot of people is, how do you get that thing that's way down deep in here that you think about at night, how does that come out to play? And you might be sitting here today and you might really love your work. I know that's true for some of you. You delight in your work. Now, work is also not just what you get paid for. Work is also what fills your schedule. What is it that you give your heart to? You might have a job that pays the bills, but then something else really delights you. Hopefully, with these thoughts, we can help you love that. Whatever it is that you give your heart to, that you will love and delight in that even more. Some may hate their work. I know that was true of some of you too. Some dread it. It is more of a means to an end. And the means is to get off work and do what it is that you really enjoy doing. Some people are kind of neutral. They don't really mind their work. It's there. The pay is good. But something deep inside tells you that your work isn't really like Genesis about like ruling over the earth in a life-giving way. Or it isn't about a creating a garden-like world where human beings can thrive. Maybe the basis of your work is consumerism, so something seems not fulfilling to you. So we want to take a few weeks and think about, a couple summers ago, we did a theology of play. So if it feels like we're overdoing it with work, go back to that series. We try to cover it all. So we did a theology of play. Now we want to look at life and work and rest for a little bit. Because the truth is, some people are still not quite sure what they are made for. Maybe you're in school, maybe you're taking some classes, some advanced classes for your work, and you're still considering that. A lot of people in this day, even into their 30s and 40s, they're like an occupational vagabond. They're still kind of wandering around, trying on different hats, seeing what might fit. Some people are at the half point in life, and so everything is changing. The kids are out of the house, and you're thinking, boy, I really wish I could have done this, or I wish I could have looked into this more, and so you want to do something different. So let's start where all stories start, right? In the beginning. For every first story in Scripture has our God at work and then also resting. So opening line in the Bible, in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. That's a Hebrew idiom. Heavens and earth. It's like when you and I say from top to bottom. It's like all-inclusive, all-encompassing. It's saying God created everything. But when you come into Genesis, we tend to think, well, there's nothing, and then God's creating substance. The substance is already there in Genesis. So there's other passages of scriptures we can say God created out of nothing. I don't think Genesis is one of those. I think that if you look closely, there's something already there. The thing about it is formless and empty. So it's really fun in the Hebrew language. I got to give you a couple Hebrew words today. I don't like doing that to show off or anything. I'm no Hebrew scholar, trust me. But a couple of these words, I think, bring out some good meaning. Here's one of them. The Hebrew word is tohu vabohu. I mean, that's a great word, isn't it? Thought about naming our dog that, but then calling him formless and void didn't seem to work for me. But it means it's like it's a barren, it's uninhabited. So there's substance, there's something there, but it's like an alien wasteland. So here's what you get in Genesis. We don't often realize this. Genesis is a temple text. So all the other temple texts, like you would read Solomon building a temple, this is God building his temple at the beginning. So those 6 days in Genesis are about God battling the forces of chaos. God is at work in the emptiness, giving it function and purpose. And on the seventh day, it doesn't mean God took a nap. On the seventh day, God assumes the throne, and the normal affairs of life can now begin. That's what it means by that God rested. He draws joy from his labor. He He sits back and says, the battle's done, and we can enjoy now the fruit of our labor, and normal life begins. And between the Genesis narrative, it is filled with metaphor after metaphor of who God is and what he is like, right? So God is an artist. Is that how you usually think of him? A designer. He's creative. He's an engineer. He's a builder. There's horticulture there. He's a zoologist, an ecologist, a musician, a poet, a king, a shepherd. The Genesis narrative says God is a good worker. He's good at work. So why would you say that? Well, because Genesis wasn't the only creation story swirling around at that time. This is how a lot of people try to discredit the Bible, because they say the Bible's creation narrative really is nothing new. There were a lot of creation stories around that time, and they were swirling around, and they say some of the same things. They have the same language, so the Bible's nothing really new. One of those stories was called, you might have heard of it, Enuma Elish. It was a Babylonian creation story, and Babylon was the cultural epicenter of antiquity. If it was good, it came from Babylon. Here in this story, the gods are tired of work. I'm kind of giving you a Cliff Notes version. But the gods are tired of work, and they go to Marduk, who is the king of the gods, and they say, you know, we're tired of work. And so he comes up with this brilliant plan to outsource work to humanity. Here's actually a line from it. My son's going to love this. I will establish a savage. That's, by the way, if you want to be updated on youth, if somebody's cool, they call them a savage, just so you know. So, and this goes all the way back to Babylon. So it's, you know, I will establish a savage. Man shall be his name. He shall be charged with the service of the gods that they might be at ease. So a lot of the other creation myths sound the same. The ones that were swirling around at this time, they all beat this same kind of plot line. The gods are tired, they're bored with work, it's kind of burdensome, it feels beneath them. So humanity is created as this kind of cheap labor force, and it makes sense, doesn't it? Humanity will offer them food and drink with our sacrifices at the temple so they can sit back at ease and be gods. You know? So in its day, see, here's what the modern mind does. We feel like we're really smart. I mean, and I thought of this in the shower today. Mankind has more information at their... You can say, Alexa, answer my question, and you have more information at your fingertips than ever. And what that does is it tends to make you arrogant and think you know more than you do. So people will approach the Bible and they say, what is this antiquated, outdated, archaic book? Like, what does this dusty ancient book say to us in these technological modern times? But we forget in its day, Genesis was a shocking cultural renegade. Because it had some of the same language, and it used, of course, the Bible's located in a particular time and place. So it's going to use the language and images of other creation myths, but it has a completely different plot line. The one true God isn't like the gods. He isn't like Marduk. He doesn't hate work. He invented it. He enjoys it. He doesn't bring humanity into being to be some kind of cheap labor force to give the gods their food and drink so they can sit back at ease, but he invites humanity to be co-creators and partners with him. So the Genesis narrative opens up and says, this good God creates the perfect setting and background and then invites you to paint and color and create alongside of him. And then Genesis used, so when Genesis talks about human beings, it's dignity. It's not just, they're a side thought so they can do our work. When it talks about humanity in Genesis, it uses the term image of God. And that word imagery carries the idea of an idol or a statue. An idol is a visual representation of an invisible being, right? In the ancient world, they would put statues in the temple of every god so that as the worshiper came in, they could know what that god is like. So Genesis comes in and says, you are God's statues or icons. The entire cosmos is his temple, and you are here to make the invisible God visible. So the plants and the trees, they worship, right? They're making noises. To me, that's worship. So the plants and the trees and the animals, if they stop one day and they say, what is God like? It should be, look at those humans. Is that how it is? I don't know. Some places maybe. But we are God's representatives to the rest of creation on his behalf. That's how you treat trees and flowers and ground and animals and other human beings. You're representing God. Matter of fact, the phrase, so I'll only do a couple of these because I know people don't sometimes care about language, but the phrase Salim Elohim, that's Hebrew, image of God, that actually was, that's not new to the Bible. That was a phrase used all over the ancient Near East, but it was used for the king. So get this. You ever been watching, you know, an Egyptian movie or something? The Pharaoh is often called Amun-Ra. You've heard that? I remember that even in kids' cartoons. You know, mummy would come back, Amun-Ra, you know. That name was used because it meant image of Ra. Ra is the Egyptian sun god. Or if you're ever reading Egyptian literature or something, you know, as you probably do every morning, you've heard the name Ramses. Ramses meant Ra is the one who begot him. So it's the Egyptian sun god. But all over the Mesopotamian world, it was used at this time, the king was referred to as the image of God. He was seen by the people as quasi-divine. He was God's representative acting on his behalf, ruling in his place. So the king was basically the high priest mediating blessing to the people and the kingdom on behalf of God, right? Now, 3 millennia later, we have the blessing of hindsight, and we kind of laugh that off as PR, or that as the propaganda of megalomaniacs, right? You know, oh, the king is the image of God. But this way of thinking, that was woven into the fabric of the ancient world. That's how people thought. And you and I as moderns now, here's what we can do. The dark underbelly of that type of thinking is this. If the king is the image of God, then you and I are not. See, the other creation stories, remember Marduk? That's a modern vision of Marduk. Marduk says humanity is just a cheap labor force. There's kind of minimum wage employees that the gods can push around and humanity can do their being. You see this? We, as moderns, we think we're so smart, but the Bible is actually in its time and place. It is so revolutionary and subversive because it comes along and says, yeah, image of God. So the reader's going, yeah, the king. No, no, it's about all humanity. All humanity are kings, not just those of royal blood, not just the oligarchy of society, not just white men. All are made in the image of God. You realize this? Any hot button issue, boy, I messed that one up. Wow. I'm going to add that to my list. I've cursed once and then I'm now. All right. Moving past that, hot button was what I was looking for. It's just a shortened version of that. Hot button issue that is being talked about today. So if you watched any debates this week, you think of any of the topics that people were still wrestling with as a civilization, you can go back to Genesis and find some answers. Like think of racism. We'll talk about racism. The Bible from the very beginning levels the human race and says you are all kings and queens and the entire earth is your kingdom. Amen. See? The very next statement in Genesis says this, so that they may rule. There is this seamless connection between image of God and rule. The word rule is radah in Hebrew. It's translated reign or have dominion. But I think a really good way to translate it is what's written there, to actively partner with Yahweh in taking the world somewhere. To be a co-creator with the Almighty to shape the world so that it might reach its full potential. Is that where we start when we tell people about the gospel? Like for me, the opening pages of our sacred text, God, that's why we call this God calling. God is looking for partners. When people think about Christianity and the Christian faith, is this where we start? Here's God's dream for the world, that he built a temple, and it's his cosmic temple, and human beings are made in his image to grow ever more in his likeness. And when he could have done everything himself, he decided to partner with us, and we get to shape this world and be his kings and queens. Usually we start with, you're nothing but a dirty, rotten sinner. It's a great start, isn't it? People are already combative at first. Instead of saying, here's what the world... Now, does the world look like this? No. So what happened? See, now I can start telling a gospel. This is God's dream. This is God's vision. This is how it was supposed to be, but it's not. So what went wrong? Think of that. From the very opening pages of scriptures, God is looking for partners. The imagery, if you want to talk about what is mankind's relationship with the gods or the one true God, it's not of a puppet on a string where God is in the heavens controlling your every move, but it is one of partnership. It is one of co-creators. God's, think of this, telling people, God's representative kings and queens ruling as high priest over his cosmic temple. Well, that's a different story. I mean, think about it. God could have kept making human beings from dust, right? But he chose to use marriage and families. He could have just made our food fall from the sky like he did with the manna, but instead he chose farming, agriculture, and trade. Could have put Adam and Eve in a full-blown city like he will in the New Jerusalem, but he put these proto-human in a garden and gave them a shot at starting civilization from scratch. Why? Because God is looking for partners, not puppets. And from one angle of theology, that is a dangerous game for God to play. There's a lot of freedom involved there. Because the very next words again in Genesis, so that they would fill the earth and subdue it. So I think one more Hebrew word here. The Hebrew word for subdue is kibosh. And believe it or not, there are a bunch of scholars who have spent an inordinate amount of time who have actually traced, put a kibosh on it, back to that Hebrew word. No joke. But kibosh can mean this. It can mean to exploit, to enslave, to abuse, even to rape. That's how many deal with the world. But it can also mean to tame something that is wild. To bring order from chaos, to bring harmony from discord. You see that when you use it like that, that's king and queen language. But here's God's risk, right? There are good kings and there are bad kings, right? There are good monarchs through the history of the world under whose rule the kingdom thrived. Civilization grew and expanded, and things are interconnected, so when it's good here, it begins to flourish all over. But then we know there are those evil tyrants whose reign is marked by oppression and injustice. They dehumanize people. They lay bare the soil of the earth. It all just, we don't know anything about that. We'll quickly move from politics. It all depends on what kind of king you have, right? In Genesis, you have both. As the story begins to unfold, you have humans doing a lot of good, right? They build a city, and it becomes the locus point of culture. So civilization begins to happen. You have technology. You begin to use bricks. They write music. They come up with the arts. They figure out how to raise livestock. Noah plants a vineyard and he makes wine, and it just, like, you keep reading the story, and so on and so on and so on. But humans also do a lot of bad. Noah builds this vineyard and then he's drunk, and the very first case of incest happens in the Bible. A guy named Lamech comes along and kind of develops this idea of polygamy, and you have the systematic oppression of women through the ages. Of course, violence starts. Cain murders his brother, and so flows human history. So you have art and science and medicine and education, and you have things like the Sistine Chapel and Handel's Messiah and New York City and photography and space travel and tacos. Tacos, I say. And then in the same world, you have 20 million slaves and racism and Holocaust. And Hiroshima, and genocide, and ISIS, and pornography, and global warming, and endangered species, and modern rap. Modern rap, I say. It is a mixed bag, right? We have the great capacity to rule in ways that cause everything to flourish and everything is blessed, and we can rule in ways that exploit the earth and rob people of an environment in which they can fully develop and thrive. That is God's risk, if you will. That's his experiment. So if you permit me this morning, let's jump from the Old Testament to the New Testament. Could we say this is why God comes as a human being? So think of it. For a millennia, he spoke as a voice, as a cloud, as a burning bush, as a whisper in a cave, but now he becomes human. Why? Because it seems that this creator God in Genesis has never given up on his dreams for Adam. He's never given up on that original intention. This is why Paul, in his writing and his theology, he connects the dots for us, and he always makes this connection, right, between Adam and Christ, to the point that he calls Jesus the last Adam. In Romans 5, he says this, it's translated differently, but Adam is the advance prototype of the one who would come. So Adam was kind of like at the center of creation, ruling and reigning, was entrusted with running the world, but he was also a signpost pointing to the one who would eventually rule forever, Jesus. But then Paul's next line makes it really interesting. He says, "For if by the trespass of the one man, death reigned through that one man, how much more will those who receive God's abundant provision of grace and the gift of righteousness reign in life through the one man, Jesus Christ?" So this is an unexpected twist for that original audience, right? So they're thinking, okay, Paul's writing and he's saying, well, this is what the world was supposed to be, but Adam really didn't do his job. He turned his back. He walked away from his calling. And so now death has entered the process and eventually we're going to die and it's going to be done. It's going to all end. Then Paul says, well, wait a minute, though. The last Adam came, and where we hijacked the story and took it this way, the last Adam came and brought it back and got it back on track. And so we're all going to live. But then the real twist is not just like in a churchy, you're going to live someday so that when you die, your soul will go to heaven and be with God. No. You will, he says, reign in life. Remember, reign is king language. It's Genesis language. Reign is what we were supposed to do all along, but Adam screwed it up. I mean, the original tent was humanity at the center of creation, being the icon, the face of God, ruling on his behalf. Adam had the first go at it, not so good. Does God give up? No, the story of the Bible is God then moves on. Okay, Abraham, how about you and your crew? You take a shot at it. And what is the Old Testament if it's nothing but this unfolding narrative of one ruler after another attempting Adam's job description? To rule the world in a life-giving way, but they fail miserably. And we can't just point, it's not like we can look back and say, well, it's just these silly characters in the past. No, it's also us. The nightly news is our report card. How are we doing? So Jesus, Paul is saying, comes as the last Adam to restore the story, to bring it back so that it's back on track and heads towards the teleos, towards the end. He was doing what Adam was supposed to do but didn't. He was doing what we were supposed to do but couldn't. This is why after the resurrection it says Jesus is given the title King of Kings, Lord of Lords. I like this line, ruler of the kings of the earth. So that Christ now fills all things everywhere with himself. So that if you're reading the Gospels, even the line at the end of the Gospel of Mark, here's what we do as church people. The end of the Mark, so you're reading along the Gospel, okay, here's Jesus, here's who he is, here's his life, his miracles, oh, they put Jesus to death, he rises again, and here's how Mark ends. Jesus was taken up into heaven, and he sits at the right hand of the throne of God. And as church people, what we tend to do is go, well, okay, the story's over. Like, humanity had a problem. God looked at humanity and had mercy. He solved the problem. Jesus was his tool to solve the problem. And then Jesus, the tool, went back to heaven. And we're just sitting here doing church stuff until someday we die and go to heaven. No. The point of the text isn't this statement of absence. It's the statement of super presence. He is filling all things everywhere with himself. So we say, what is God doing? Not waiting for us to get to heaven. He's working. He's ruling and reigning right now. And what is the first thing he does with his rule? Shares it with us. Shares it with us. Why? Because from the very beginning, the story of God, he has been calling and looking for partners, not puppets. See, is the story coming full circle now for us? The very first theologian to take Paul's thought, it was Irenaeus, he sat in Paul's church, grew up in his church, and he heard this connection of Adam and Jesus. And so Irenaeus developed what is called the recapitulation theory. So he took it even a little bit further, and he said, that's just a fancy word of saying that what God is doing through Jesus in his death and resurrection is what Adam was supposed to do all along, reigning and ruling. So recapitulation just means reconciling, renewing, restoring, renovating all things. We took it to the trash heaps. We were headed towards, Athanasius says, non-being. We were headed nowhere very quickly. Jesus grabs the story, puts it back on track, does what Adam and we were supposed to do all along, and now the story is headed towards its intended purpose. So that's he came and restored what Adam had lost, and now we rule and reign with him. This is what we are made for. So what does this mean for us? All of this talks of kings and queens, you say, well, that helps understand the Bible more. But talk of kings and queens is fine, but we don't live in the ancient Near East anymore. We work at restaurants and offices, and we're full-time moms and architects and students and doctors. What does that mean for us? Well, for starters, it means, as we begin this series, for starters, it means that work is a core part of your humanness. It's very popular in church now, and I agree with this statement, to say, you aren't just what you do, it's who you are, right? Because we don't want to just be doing, and that's true. But I think we can go too far either way, because work is a core part of who we are. You are made in the image of a working God. God is king over the world. You are a king and queen to rule on his behalf. And what you and I do is we gather up in our work all of creation's goodness, and we give it right back to God. That's what a high priest. So really, if you nailed it down, when you fill out paperwork and they say, what is your occupation? I would like you to start writing high priest. One, just to see how they look at you when you hand that back to them. But in truth, that's what you are. The way your high priestness works itself out will look different from person to person, but you are a high priest taming the chaos and giving it back to God in thankfulness. That's a vision of humanity right there. When you get up tomorrow and you go to work, it isn't just about paying the bills. It isn't just learning microbiology. It isn't just raising children. It isn't just serving at a nonprofit. You're being human. You're being human. You're ruling over the earth and taming a certain section or station of the world that God has given you. Does that give you a different vision of tomorrow? Like you get to walk into some of the emptiness and chaos. God gave the foundation, but you get to walk into some of that and color it and create it and tame it and be you and shape that. And God says this, that your work is good. When God was done with everything, imagine him battling. Like I picture a soldier and he's battling chaos and emptiness and he's saying, no, instead here is going to be function and purpose and I'm going to install functionaries, the stars and the sky and the animals. And he does all that battling and then he sits down on his throne. He sits back and he admires the goodness. Maybe that's what we are to do at the end of the day, to sit back and say, today was good. I got to partner with God in doing something this day. Because too often, I think we think of work as a curse. You know, how many times have you heard, now some people are in a bad situation, they're just trying to pay the bills, but a lot of times people say, man, I hate work. We tend to think of like God judged us in Genesis and now you have to work. And of course, our work can be cursed. More on that later. But work itself, inherently work is a blessing. This passage in Genesis says this, God blessed them and said, be fruitful, fill the earth, subdue it, rule. A blessing is a weighty thing in Genesis. Like it is a gift from the Creator God to generate life, to generate fertility, to generate well-being. So when God looks over human beings and says, I want to bless you, what does he do? He gives them work. What we'll see next week, be fruitful and multiply, what that means. It's really about building civilization. But God's original intent was for always for human beings to join him. You want to know what it means to look like God? What did he do in the beginning? He stepped into the emptiness and chaos, and he separated, and he filled, and he gave it function and purpose. And God's intention was always that you would step into this world and separate and fill and color and add you to that and then follow him in this beautiful rhythm of work but also rest. I got to tell you, we are in desperate need in this culture to recapture that stunning vision of humanness. We need that. The last thing is this. So Genesis also says this. Every human being that you will encounter this week is bursting with raw potential. Sometimes it doesn't feel like it. If we're honest, deep inside, there's people we encounter that go, they're a little beneath me. They don't look quite as good. They might not be as intelligent. They might not have reached the pinnacle in life that we have. But every creature that you encounter is bursting with raw potential. You have it. You have the blood of royalty running through your veins. So one of our callings as Christians is this. Wherever you find yourself this week, wherever you're at, whatever you're doing, try to stop and remind yourself, I'm royalty. I am here and put in this moment to be a king or a queen made to rule, made to subdue, to have, the translation Bruce used is to have sway over, to partner with God in this moment to speak into people's lives and plants' lives and animals' lives and the culture life. You have this dizzying amount of pent-up potential in you to do good or to do evil. Friends, I hope you feel, that is a weighty thing. Tomorrow morning, you might feel insignificant when you look out at the vastness of the cosmos, but tomorrow morning, you have the potential to do good, to speak into another creature's life and say, you are beautiful and you are good, and they walk away from meeting with you and they're better, and then whatever they touch, it happens, you see the ripple effect. Or you have the ability to be like the rest of culture and kind of not thankful and, another day at work, see all the bad and things, and then you just ripple effect that. You see? Genesis is looking at us this morning, I think, and asking you this question. What kind of ruler will you be? It's easy to judge the guy in Korea, Donald Trump. It's easy to judge people in those positions already, but Genesis says to you, what kind of ruler will you be over your sector? You were made to do good. You were made to mirror and mimic what God is like to the world. You were made to stand at the interface between the Creator and His creation and to implement His generous blessing over the earth. And you were made to give voice to that which is voiceless. Like the trees, they make noise. The wind is blowing through and they make noise. The grass in all of its glory, it's making this noise. But you as the high priest are to walk by and touch all of those things and give vocal words to it in praise to the Creator. That's our job. May we be good and faithful servants in that. There was a picture I showed you, and we try to always do some kind of practice, and I showed you a more modernized picture of this earlier, but there's two versions. This one's a little dark. It's the best we could do. But we do something here called Lectio Divini. It's a fancy word to say sacred word. So we're going to do something else today. We're going to do Visio Divini. So we're going to do a visual instead of word-oriented. And this is Mia, or Malay. It's French, so you got me on that. I plugged in the pronouncement of his name, and every person that said it pronounced it differently. So I think you can say what you want. But Millet was a French peasant, grew up in a peasant family, and his parents worked long hours as laborers in the fields, and so that was instilled in him a love of nature. And this famous painting that hangs, I believe, in Paris is known as the Angelus, because that's the time or prayer hour that people would stop three times a day, usually morning, afternoon, and evening, and they would stop their work wherever they were at. And what he did is he observed his parents. He's actually called the peasant painter. And that's the world in which he was born. And this painting was very much considered a reflection of his childhood experience, watching his father and his mother work in the fields, gathering potatoes there, but then stopping. You can see in the far background there, there's kind of a church steeple. And the bells would ring and people would stop in the midst of their day and gather up creation and give it back to the Creator. So let me pull up a different version. I'm just going to ask you to went past it. Well, if I get too far back here, this thing does some crazy things. There we go. There's maybe a version that adds a little more light to it. And just, almost like you do with Lectio, just stare at this painting for a minute. Because this was a practice that people have done through the ages. It's a way of doing ceaseless prayer. Like God says, pray without ceasing. Pray all the time. Well, that doesn't mean on your knees all the time, but it means like be in this state or this posture of prayer. So the Angelus is like a simple prayer suitable for anybody, but it's a biblical reminder of like when Gabriel appeared to Mary in the midst of her mundane, and he said, you're going to bring forth the Savior of the world. And then her response was, behold, the bondslave of the Lord, may it be done to me as you've said. And then the Angelus prays John 1, the incarnation. Jesus became flesh. So traditionally, that was recited three times a day at dawn, noon, and dusk, each time you were reminded by it by the ringing of the church bells in the background. So for a moment today, just be still before this image as if you've just heard those church bells yourself calling you to prayer and stillness. So the painting just presents two peasants in a field near the close of the day. You see the faint outline of a city behind them in the distance. Kind of look at the focus of the painting as those two peoples. They kind of dominate the landscape. But this is a moment of deep and quiet reverence. All work has stopped for a moment as the man and woman stand in bowed silence while they reflect on the incarnation of Jesus and they do the evening prayer. Privately each prays. They maybe meditate on that scripture of Mary being visited by the angel. And they ponder on the mystery of her willing surrender to God's will and the Word made flesh. The man has his hat in his hand, stands in devout humility and worship. The woman bows her head, her hands kind of tightly clasped in prayer, close to her heart. It's an intensely private moment for each, and yet that shared prayer together unites them in a holy alliance, reminding them God is present. At their feet is a large basket of potatoes, which they have left unattended to observe this ritual. Beside the man is his pitchfork, which he has set aside, stuck upright in the ground. Behind the woman is a wheelbarrow with bags containing the fruit of their labors. And in the misty distance, you see that spire of the village church, and it would have been the bells from that church that summoned these people to pray. Even in this work, it's inviting you to stillness and meditation. The figures are immobile, the tools of their trade for a moment abandoned. And this moment, think of this, in the midst of their work, this moment of prayer somewhat transports them into God's time. And I feel, when I look at this painting, I've always loved this painting, I always feel attracted to that, the faith that is being displayed here by these farmers. They invite us to take more frequent, brief moments to look into the face of God as we go throughout our life and to give our work back to the Creator as He has given it to us in the beginning. So would you do this for a moment? Look at this picture and do what they're doing. Join these two farmers in their silence and their stillness before God. Allow yourself for a moment just to be drawn into this scene. Your life experience may be different than theirs, but join these farmers in a moment of prayer. So would you just, as you look at the image, be drawn into stillness before your Creator, and then let that move you into thankfulness for your life. Think of specific things in your life, your job, the way you've earned money, the things that you delight in doing, and just picture yourself doing those things and giving them back to the Creator.